Several years ago, someone challenged me, along with some other women, to pray a very bold prayer. Lord, let me see myself as you see me. Let me see myself as I really am. Now that can go in several different directions. I have a friend who really struggles with the way she sees herself. She's constantly beating herself up. She doesn't have very much self-confidence at all. She doesn't like her body. She doesn't like so many things about herself. And when she prayed, Lord, let me see myself as you see me. Let me see myself as I really am. What she heard was, you are beautiful and valuable, and I love you, and I like you. She wasn't expecting that. That's not what I got. I struggle, as so many people do, with pride of various kinds. And what God did to answer my prayer was to show me how much I need him and how dark my flesh is, that part of me that operates independent from God. And several years ago, I met a guy online, not my husband, and I got a big-time crush on him. Nothing ever happened. Everything that happened was in my own heart and in my own head. But I realized how easy it was to live this double life of, you know, continuing with the life that everybody knew me to be. And on the side, I'm thinking thoughts about a man I'm not married to that I have no business thinking. And so when I prayed, God, show me, let me see myself as I really am, he very graciously showed me how dark my heart is and how much I need him. But it didn't stop there. After I confessed my sin of having inappropriate thoughts and feelings to my husband, who forgave me, sorry, I love you, you know. Then, as I'm swimming laps one day, God says, I want you to confess to the women in the women's ministry of your church. And I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know that anybody's ever done anything like that. And he said, I want you to humble yourself and confess your sin of, you know, your thought life to the women that you've been involved in ministering to and with. And I was like, oh, no, not, no, I don't want to do that. And until I finally, because the Holy Spirit kept pressuring me gently and lovingly, finally I said, okay, well, if you set up the situation that would make it more natural than calling them up and going, hey, I have something I got to say, I will obey. In your strength and in your power, I will obey. And the next thing I knew, I got a phone call from the person leading the Bible study. And we were doing a study on prayer where a different woman would teach the Bible study each week, and we were doing, you know, fill-in-the-blank type things and then having discussion. I get this call, Sue, would you, I'm lining up teachers for this prayer book, would you do chapter 6? It's going to be on such and such a date. And she didn't say what it was. I wasn't looking at the book. And I said, sure, whatever it is, I'm happy to do that. So I opened the book, and I kid you not, the name of the chapter is Public Confession of Sin. Oh, no. I was just like, really, God? Are you kidding me? So I did. I mean, before I said anything else, when I got, it was my turn, I confessed my sin and asked forgiveness for being less than honest and open about the struggle that I'd been having. And it was, needless to say, very, very hard. One of the older women just sat there in front of everybody else. She said, Sue, we love you. We forgive you. you're fine, you're good. And I so appreciated the sweet acceptance and forgiveness and openness. And nothing changed because of receiving grace from people. And that's what whetted my appetite for transparency and authenticity, of particularly how needed it is in the church. It's needed in our relationships. It's needed in our families. It's needed everywhere. What does it mean to be transparent? Well, when you're transparent, people know what you're feeling and how you're reacting to life. You don't have any walls up that keep you opaque so that people don't know what's behind these defensive walls. Masks and walls keep people from connecting with our hearts. And a transparent person doesn't have masks. They don't have walls. It's not that they don't have any privacy, but they don't have parts of them that are blocking their real heart from others. Of course, the first thing you think of with the word transparent is a window, something that you can clearly see through. And one time I was meditating on a scripture from 2 Corinthians 12 where Paul was talking about the different sufferings that he had gone through. And he said he asked the Lord three times that this thorn in the flesh would leave him. And God said to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I'm well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Now, I remember looking at that thinking, okay, some biblical truths are like Easter eggs. You know, you got your basket and you just go around and you pluck up the Easter egg and you stick it in your basket. Other biblical truths are like nuggets of gold. They need to be mined. It takes some work to pull them out. And I had a sense that this was one of them. And so I asked the Lord, help me mine this truth. What does it mean that when I'm weak, you are strong? And what he showed me is that is the difference between a window and an opaque wall. A window is transparent. You see through it. It's fragile. It's easily broken. If you pick up a big cement block and hurl it at a window, it will break the window. If you pick up that same cement block and you hurl it at a brick wall, it'll just bounce right off. An opaque wall is strong and it'll fight off all kinds of attacks, but you can't see through it. The light only comes in through a window. And what I saw was that when we are weak and we give our weakness to the Lord, he is strong in our weakness and he can shine his strength and his beauty and his glory through us when we are windows. That's what it means to be transparent. People can see through us so that Jesus shines through. And I thought, I want to be transparent like that. Real transparency isn't self-conscious. It just is. People who get their who grit their teeth and think, "I will now be transparent and real," do not get it. You don't have to grit your teeth to be transparent. A window isn't self-aware. It doesn't sit there going, "I will now be available for light to shine through me." It just is transparent. And where we start being transparent is with a decision that by God's grace, that's how I want to be, Lord. Show me how to be transparent. Let me be a window. Because, you know, Jesus was all windows and no walls. There was no part of him that was opaque that the Father could not shine through. He was completely transparent. And he said, "You've seen me, you've seen the Father. I've held back nothing. You know, what you see is what you get here." He was all windows. And we love people who are transparent and let us see God in them through their windowness. That's transparency. I want to talk some about authenticity. Authenticity means the real thing. It means that something is genuine. When someone's authentic, it means we're the same person at home and at church and at work and online. we treat people the same way, whether they're family or strangers. It means not having to remember who you are in a certain situation. You don't have to remember your persona because you're the same person all the time. And when we hang around transparent and authentic people, we get blessings from that because we can see God at work in them. And especially when they start telling stories, because they're willing to be open about, this is my life as God is working in me. I will never forget this lady telling me in her transparency and authenticity about a time when she was less than sweet and wonderful to Jesus. She was at a conference and in a room like this, and she was in line up the aisle at the end of the service to get some prayer. There was a ministry team up front, and she was in line, and she said, Jesus, I really need you to meet with me today. And so when I get up there to the front of the church, would you please meet with me? And I want to receive a blessing from you. And as soon as she prayed that, she suddenly remembered a time when she was 7 years old, and she was a little girl, and it was time for her first Holy Communion. And in her church tradition, little girls wore a white dress and a white veil and usually white patent leather shoes. And it's a big hoopla, and there's a party, and there's pictures and all this stuff. But her daddy said to her, sweetheart, we're so excited that it's time for your first Holy Communion, but we don't have enough money for a new dress and new shoes. So you're going to need to decide, do you want the new white dress or do you want the new white shoes? We can only do one. Well, she chose the white dress. And she's remembering this as she's standing there in the aisle, remembering being the only girl in her communion class who had a white dress and black patent leather shoes because that's all she had. And she was so embarrassed. Of course, the other girls laughed at her, like, what's wrong with your shoes? And it was so painful. She was standing there in line, waiting to get up to the front. And she's like, Jesus, I asked you to minister to me. I asked you to, like, love on me. And you remind me of this really painful time in my childhood when I was so embarrassed and so hurt. Why would you do this? Why would you bring up these hurting feelings? And in her spirit, she saw herself standing there being the little girl in the white dress and the white veil and the black patent leather shoes. And here comes Jesus looking at her in his long robe and his flowing hair. And as he's approaching her, he's smiling. And he gets really close to her and he winks. And he pulled up his long tunic, and what he's wearing is black patent leather shoes. And she suddenly realized that Jesus had entered into her embarrassment. Jesus had entered into her pain. He was right there with her when that happened. And when she realized that Jesus was right there in her embarrassment, this huge chunk of healing hit her heart. And she just thanked him so much for being Emmanuel, God with us. And I remember thinking, thank you for telling me that awesome story. She was willing to risk being authentic and transparent to tell the story when she got a little snippy attitude toward Jesus for giving her a memory she didn't really like. And it ended up blessing her and everybody she ever told the story to. But you know, when someone is authentic, it's most effective when it comes from people at the top, people in leadership. Whether it's the father in a family, or a pastor, or the head of a ministry, or the president, or the CEO of a company. And one of the things that I have learned over the years that I've been at my church, where the bedrock values are transparency and authenticity, is that it's modeled by our pastor and all the elders. And one time, our pastor wanted to communicate to the people in our church that, yeah, I may serve you as the head shepherd here, as one of your pastors, But I am a fallen, broken, jacked up human being who needs Jesus just as much as you do. And you need to know that apart from Jesus, I am such a mess. My flesh is just as ugly as anybody else's. And then he proceeded to tell us about a time when he went skiing. He and his wife went skiing with the other elders and their wives. And he somehow sustained a concussion and didn't know about it. And so he was on the ski lift, and he saw a ski instructor who was, he was with some ski ladies, you know, in their little white outfits. And he started making these way inappropriate comments about ski bunnies and Playboy bunnies and this elder's wife and what would she look like as a Playboy bunny, you know. And it's like, whoa, 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 Todd, come on, dude, what are you saying? And he had no idea what he was saying. He said, I also learned that when I had some surgery and I came out of the surgery, they told my wife that on my chart it says, patient is combative when coming out of anesthesia, because he comes, you know, awake and starts wanting to punch everybody. He said, that's me. That's your pastor, okay? I am, he said, how did he put this? He said, that, ever heard of a happy drunk? Well, I'm a pornographic drunk and a violent drunk. That's what's inside of me, okay? That's what my flesh is like. And apart from the fact that Jesus Christ lives inside of me, the fact that you don't see that is testimony to how powerful he is, that his spirit overwhelms my flesh. It's a testimony to how much I need Jesus, and that we all need Jesus, and the ground is level at the foot of the cross. We all need Jesus that much. So, you know, you need to understand that church leadership is comprised of people who are just as fallen as the people in the seats, and they need Jesus just as much as anybody else. Well, turns out, I found out recently, that there was a lady who was visiting the church that day, and someone met her several months later and told her what church that he went to, and she goes, I visited your church. I will never be back. And said, really? Why? Because it's growing, like exploding, she said. The pastor says he struggles with lust. I don't want to go to a church where a pastor struggles with lust. And he said, do you understand that there are two kinds of men? Those that admit they struggle with lust and those who don't admit that they struggle with lust. At least he's honest about it and he holds himself accountable. So I just think, I want to follow someone who's that kind of authentic, who doesn't have any illusions about being holier than me or anybody else. That's the kind of person that I want to follow. That's the kind of person, the kind of Christ follower that I want to be. And of course, we've got a really great model in the Lord Jesus, who modeled transparency to us. He asked for what he needed. When he met the woman at the well, he was thirsty. He said, would you please give me a drink of water? He asked for what he needed. Now, he fed 5,000 people on one occasion and 4,000 on another. He could have snapped his fingers and had there been a cup of water in his hand, but he didn't. He asked for what he needed so that he could involve her in the process. When Peter, James, and John were there praying with him in Gethsemane, he told them, guys, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Please stay here with me and keep watch with me. He said, I'm hurting really bad. I need you to hang in there with me. Wait with me. Pray for me, please. He asked for what he needed. At Lazarus's tomb, even though he was about to raise one of his best friends from the dead, he wept. He was so overwhelmed by the horribleness of death and sin and the effects of corruption in our world. Jesus was transparent. He was all windows. It's a risk, though, to be authentic and transparent. So what does it take for that to flourish and grow in us? Well, I think that in order for us to be transparent and authentic, we need to be in the presence of safe people. And I would love to share with you what it means to be safe. But maybe to set that up, it would be helpful to talk a little bit about what unsafe people are like. Of course, if I were to ask for stories, there are probably as many stories as there are women in this room about unsafe people. Unsafe people don't understand their own depravity. They don't understand their own brokenness and their need for Jesus. Unsafe people believe there's this hierarchy of sin where my sins don't stink nearly as bad as yours. They don't understand how really revolting sin is in every form to God. Unsafe people communicate in various ways, whether it's with their words or their body language, their raised eyebrow, their cold shoulder, that it's not okay to mess up. They communicate that it's not okay to be imperfect. And if you dared to share a struggle with them, they might challenge you or attack you or dismiss you. In many places, it's unsafe to say, I am really struggling with depression, which in any given room, probably at least 20 to 30% of the women especially are struggling with depression. But an unsafe person will respond by saying things like, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. If you're having problems, you must not be walking in obedience to God. You must be doing something wrong. If you're depressed, it's your fault. Real Christians don't get depressed. But Jesus was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He understands sadness at its greatest depth. Unsafe people are going to just dismiss your struggles if you share with them. Guess what? You're never going to share with them again, are you? And if you reveal an unflattering truth about yourself, they're going to withdraw. You know, it might be contagious. And it's painful. And people know, you know, I'm just not being invited anywhere. No, nobody's coming and sitting at my table. Suddenly, if I'm sitting here, there's nobody on either side of me. People have a way of communicating. You're not good enough. Unsafe people depend on manipulation to get their way. They're certainly not going to be direct and simply ask for what they want or need. They're dishonest. You cannot trust their word because they're not safe. And they have loose lips. They cannot keep a confidence. The juicy gossip is way too much of a temptation. Unsafe people cannot keep a secret, so you cannot tell them anything that matters. In comparison, one of the pastors at our church told my husband and me that their community group modeled transparency and authenticity to such a degree that every couple in this community group brought their checkbooks and their income tax forms to the group and laid it out in front of everybody. This is how we spend our money. There are very few things other than getting dressed in front of a crowd of people that is revealing as letting people know how you spend your money. How in the world do you get in a position where it's safe to share with people your deepest, darkest truths? Forget the secrets, just your truths. So what does it take to be a safe person? Well, it starts with owning your own brokenness and your own need for Jesus. It starts with admitting, I'm not perfect. I'm far from it. As a matter of fact, it means dropping the unrealistic hope and pretense of being perfect in this lifetime. There's not even any point in using the word perfect because it's not possible on the side of eternity. So let's just drop that expectation of ourselves and of others. It means being open about our hurt and our pain and our failings and our humanity, which we all have, but being willing to share it as people reveal themselves to be safe. It means really getting that there but for the grace of God go I, that so often things happen to people and it's just God's grace that it's not happening to us, whether it's getting caught and given an expensive speeding ticket or getting cancer. I mean, so many things that could happen to us but are happening to somebody else, and it could easily be me. There's nothing special about me that would keep all the bad stuff away. When safe people who own their own brokenness, don't try to appear to have it all together. They're not putting on a face, a mask, and keeping defensive walls up that says, I am Susie Perfect, and I want you to see me as I present myself to you, as opposed to how I really am. We just realize, I don't have it all together, and I'm not going to try. It just takes way too much energy to keep up the pretense of having it all together when nobody has it all together. We live in a fallen world. We're fallen sinners. We desperately need Jesus. All of us do. So let's just accept that. A safe person is humble. That means being right-sized, not thinking too much of yourself nor too little, but being right-sized. It's kind of like the Goldilocks. Happy medium. If a person is humble, the safe person doesn't look down on others from their superior position, because they're right down there at the foot of the cross. They know that the ground is level there, and they don't put others on a pedestal either. That's a dangerous thing to do to anybody, because it hurts so bad when you topple off your pedestal. So they just kind of kick pedestals out. They don't climb up on them, and they don't put anybody else on them. Safe people understand grace and give it to others. One of my favorite, now this is my favorite definition of grace, comes from John Ortberg out in California, who says, grace is the offer of God's ceaseless presence in irrational love that cannot be stopped. It's the flow of God's power and presence and favor in your life from one moment to the next that enables you to do whatever it is God has for you to do. Love that full description of grace. It goes so far beyond unmerited favor. Big time goes beyond it. As a matter of fact, I recently wrote a radio program for Probe that's on probe.org called The Glory of Grace that I would love for you to read, because it's so fun to talk about grace. Grace is acceptance. That's at the core of grace. It means I accept you just the way you are. Acceptance doesn't mean agreeing with someone. It doesn't mean stamping that everything they do is okay. God accepts us just as we are, but he doesn't agree with our sin. It just means I acknowledge that you have the right to be who you are, where you are, and I'm not going to fight against it. I'm just going to accept reality. I choose to accept reality. Several years ago, my sister-in-law was horrified as one of the Bible teachers in her church, one of the leaders in her women's ministry, was horrified to discover that their oldest daughter was unmarried and pregnant. And she was heartbroken, she was angry, she was disappointed. Of course, you can imagine what that feels like when the dreams that you've had for your child are suddenly changed forever. And as she was processing through this, she got a little snippy attitude and said to God one day, I suppose you want me to help put together a shower for her. And the Lord said, every child deserves to be welcomed and celebrated, regardless of the circumstances of their conception. Whoa. And so when she heard that, she chose to accept reality as it is, to accept that there was going to be an unwed mother in the family, that there was going to be a child coming into the family. And no child, with the possible exception of my own, was ever welcomed with as much enthusiasm and grace and acceptance and celebration as precious little Kaylin. And it's been real interesting to see how God has unfolded that unfortunate circumstance of her conception. But she is absolutely precious. She now loves Jesus. Her mom is now a Christian. Her mom married a wonderful man who is now a Christian, and although they live in another state, we got invited to the web stream of her baptism because she was the most vibrant Christian in their family. Yeah, it worked out really well to celebrate that child with the grace of acceptance. A safe person encourages others by their example to be on the outside what we are on the inside. A safe person remembers that there are two sides to every story and wants to, and waits to make a judgment until they hear the other side. That is such a precious gift to give to someone, to not jump to conclusions before they hear the other side of the story. A safe person maintains a non-judgmental attitude. They're not critical of others because they know that they themselves need to be treated without judgment and without criticism. Safe people don't shame others, whether it's verbally or with our body language, that basically says, you're not good enough. You're not okay the way you are. Safe people don't criticize others. Safe people are honest. They speak the truth in love, as Ephesians tells us. And safe people are good listeners. When they're listening to the other person talking, they're not already thinking, now what am I going to say as soon as that person shuts up? They're like a bucket. And they receive whatever the person is saying, and they're listening. And then safe people will say things like, okay, so what I heard you say was XYZ, to show I was listening, I was paying attention, because what you were saying really matters. And I want to make sure I get it, because you're valuable, you're important, and what you say and what you think matters, and I want you to get that. Safe people love with God's love. They understand that there is a pipeline from God's heart to the other person, and it can come through us. We don't have to generate love for other people. We just surrender and let God love other people through us. We're just a pipeline. And safe people are forgivers. They extend to others the forgiveness that they themselves have received from God and from other people. The best people you're ever going to want to meet are forgiven forgivers, which is the best description of husbands and wives that I've ever heard in order to have a good, healthy relationship. We need it in women's ministries. We need it in Bible studies. We need it in church staffs. We need it in businesses. We need it everywhere. Forgiven forgivers. When safe people are in leadership, it means they realize that brokenness and struggle and an inability to be anything more than just what I am are normal parts of the sanctification process, of becoming like Jesus. They understand that there will be stumbles and there will be falls. They're not horrified when it happens. They expect it. They're not shocked when it happens. They remember that Proverbs says that a man can fall down 6 times, but he gets up 7, and he needs to keep getting up. It's about understanding we are fallen, broken people. We can't help but stumble and fall. We're going to expect that. And so when it happens, we say not, how shame on you, how dare you. We say, I'm so sorry. I know that really hurts, and you had to confess it, and that really stinks, and I'm sorry, and I love you, and I pray for you, and I will walk out this issue with you. So how do you learn to connect with the safe people that God gives you? Let me give you some suggestions. First of all, learn to ask for help. One of the greatest words of wisdom I ever heard in my entire life are, healthy people ask for what they need. I also learned that healthy people ask for what they want. Makes a big, big difference. This last Sunday, my husband had the most amazing blessing and honor of his entire life. Probe Ministries is an apologetics and worldview ministry. We help people think biblically, and we help people develop confidence that Christianity is true by teaching apologetics, making a defense for the faith. His area is faith and science. All of his education is in biology. And there was an apologetics conference at Saddleback Church in Southern California. And he was one of 5 speakers this weekend, speaking on evidence for a creator from biology. And by the time all the videos are finished and what they're going to be doing at that church with the 32,000 people in their weekly Bible studies, is by far the largest audience he's ever spoken to. It's just a tremendous honor to be asked to be one of the speakers at this apologetics conference. Well, he'd been sick for about like a week and a half. His voice was very, very fragile, and we had a lot of people praying for him. The morning he was to speak, Sunday morning, he goes to the fitness center at the hotel, and he gets on the treadmill, and he set his glasses in this little tray, and they were bouncing, and he's like, this is not going to work. So he took off the glasses, and he put them on the floor next to the treadmill. Yeah. Yeah. You know what I'm going to say. When he got off the treadmill, because he never puts his glasses on the floor, he heard crunch, and they were just broken into all these pieces. The lenses were intact, but everything else was broken. And he just laughed. He said, okay, in this morning, Lord, you really impressed on me that in my weakness, you will be strong. So now I'm doubly weak. I'm not only sick, I'm half blind. So he got himself ready. He tucked his broken glasses in his pocket, and he got to the church. And this is a lesson that he's been learning over the last couple of years, is that healthy people ask for what they need. And he said in the past, he wouldn't have done that, you know, because that's part of the mask. Everything's fine. No one needs to know that I actually wear glasses. So he decided to do something different. Healthy people ask for what they need, right? So he saw one of the pastors. He reached into his pocket, and he pulled out the broken glasses, and he said, do you think there's any way, there's someone here that could help me get these fixed? And the guy looked at him and said, well, let me see what I can do. And someone took them to the Walmart. They were open when the Vision Center opened at 9, I mean, they were there when the Vision Center opened at 9 a.m., and they got fixed, and an hour later, they handed Ray his glasses. Amazing. I love, that was God just showing off. And he said, you know, in the past, I would have really been crippled by not having my glasses, but God blessed me by being willing to ask for what I needed. I needed to be transparent and authentic about the fact that I am in a hot spot here with my broken glasses, and look what God did, because I asked for what I needed. It was amazing what a difference that made. When we ask for what we need, it develops humility in us. It destroys illusions of self-sufficiency. It reminds us that we are incomplete and we need other people. It's why God wants us in community. When we ask for what we need, it allows us to own our needs, to take responsibility for them. I mean, that means things like asking for love and understanding and comfort. Saying things like, okay, I have a need. And it's not your problem. It's not your responsibility. You don't have to respond, but I would like something from you. And I'm just going to ask if that's something that you could give me. It frees the other person to connect with you freely and without obligation. It's kind of like when you're playing the game Go Fish, and you're looking at your cards, and you say to the other person, do you have a four? And they say, no, I don't have a four. You don't say, you are kidding. What kind of Christian are you to not have a four? You know, you don't shame them. You don't condemn them. They just say, no, I don't have a four. Go fish. And then you go to the pile. You go to another source. And you don't give the other person responsibility for the fact that you need a four. It's kind of like that in life as well. When we own that our own needs are our own responsibility, we allow other people to love us and to give us what we need because they want to and not because we're trying to demand it from them or manipulate it out of them. When we ask for what we need and what we want, we're taking initiative. We're not passively hoping and wishing that someone will read our mind and sense our pain and see our need and intuitively just come to our rescue so that we don't ever have to ask. They just show up like as if they had a magic wand. Asking keeps us much more in control of our lives rather than hoping that someone will just figure out that I need ibuprofen and will come up to me and say, hi, you look like you're in pain. Do you want some ibuprofen? Ask for what you need. It increases the odds we'll get something. One of the women in our community group was going through a very painful divorce, and she said, I'm very uncomfortable asking this, but I want to ask you all, can somebody sit with me in the courtroom when I go through this? Because I just really need somebody to be with me. And she had a bunch of us with her because she asked for what she needed. Just as I close, what happens when someone shows vulnerability to you? When they are, by their risking, sharing with you their heart, they're saying, are you a safe person? Can I trust my heart with you? Let me give you three suggestions of what to do when someone trusts you with their heart. First of all, affirm them. Tell them, wow, it took a lot of courage for you to just share that with me. I feel so honored that you have shared your heart. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so proud of you. Way to go. And pray for them right there. It is one of the great blessings of life to have someone pray for us out loud right there. Even on the street or in the hallway of the church or on the phone, it's an amazing thing to say, may I pray for you right now? And if you're not comfortable doing that, I'll tell you the secret. Act as if you already were comfortable. And just do it. And then after a while, you'll become comfortable with it. Works every time. The second thing you can do to respond to someone's vulnerability is to know that when people risk being open, they're usually thinking, all right, what are they thinking about me now? I'm never going to be able to face them again. And so the best thing you can do when someone has risked being vulnerable with you is to make your face to shine upon them, just like in the Aaronic blessing in the Old Testament. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord lift your face and make his face to shine upon you and love them with your eyes, love them with your face, and show them that everything's great. I'm still here. This changes nothing except that I feel honored and I respect you more. And then third, when someone risks being vulnerable with you, follow up with them later to let them know that you appreciate them, you appreciate the risk that they took, and then you affirm them again on the other side. It's a wonderful thing to be transparent and authentic. It's an amazing thing to offer to other people, I'm safe. Your heart is safe in my heart. Your name is safe in my mouth. And I just want to encourage you to love each other, love the people in your life by being safe and risking being transparent and authentic. Thank you.